This last June, my brother, his wife, and I visited Rwanda, the land of my birth. Today, I want to share some impressions of our visit. As I reflect on the stories of the people of Rwanda, people who lived there 70 years ago, and people who are living there now. As we look at the history of the country and the history of Adventism in Rwanda, I am going to ask three questions. And I want you to ponder those questions. I want you to take them home with you. I will tell the story of a day during the genocidal storm that swept over Rwanda in 1994. Then we will listen to what has been said about this terrible storm. Finally, I will ask you what is in your heart as we reflect on the lessons of Rwanda. Let us pause a moment for prayer. Heavenly Father, be very close to us today. The story we will hear is a difficult one to tell. Give us ears to hear. Open our eyes so that we may see. And give us hearts to understand. Amen. Rwanda is located in Central Africa, and it's about the size of the state of Maryland. The population density is the highest in any of the countries in Africa. The most sobering fact about the people of Rwanda is that 42% of the population is less than 15 years of age, and the child and infant mortality rate is the highest in Africa. A majority of the people live in small plots in the country. Only 3% of the country remains in its natural forested state. Rwanda is very beautiful. It is known as the land of 1,000 hills. As one travels through the countryside, you can see postage-sized plots clinging to the steep hillsides. These little plots must support the families that farm them. What they yield is inadequate at best. It is hard to appreciate the impact that this crowded living has on the country as you drive through the beautiful countryside. We shall see population density was certainly a factor that led to the storm that swept over this land in 1994. The first people to settle this area were the Twa, or as we would call them, the Pygmy, the short people. They now make up less than 1% of the population of this country. The Hutu, or people of a moderate stature, more like most of us, followed. They now make up about 84% of the population. The Tutsi came in the 1300s. They are known as the tall ruling class. The Tutsi kings and the chiefs controlled the Hutu and the Twa in a feudal system of government. Cattle became the basis of exchange. All cattle were owned by the king. The chief would lease out cattle and in turn would pass them on to the local villagers. As payment, the villagers had to give a specified number of days each year in service to the chief. Mother used to tell of seeing the chief walking around with people following him, and maybe all their service was just to follow him around for a day or two. It would show that he had owned a lot of cattle. This system of forced servitude heightened the distinctions that separated the ruling Tutsi from the Hutu servants. These tribal animosities were certainly a factor that led to the storm that swept over Rwanda in 1994. Rwanda was part of German East Africa from 1894 until after the First World War. Then it became a Belgian protectorate under the League of Nations, and many of us in geography class in school would have known it probably as Rwanda-Urundi. In 1962, it gained its independence. The Belgians supported the feudal system of Tutsi domination. Every citizen was required to carry an identification card which included a tribal label: Twa, Hutu, or Tutsi. The fact that intermarriage had blurred the distinctive tribal characteristics did not matter. The Belgians demanded a tribal label. These identity cards came to be a death sentence to many during the storm that swept over this country in 1994, when tribalism became deadly. Today, most Rwandans, 94%, call themselves Christian. About 57% are Roman Catholic, 26% are Protestant, and incidentally, we are not counted in that 26 Protestant percent. 11% are Seventh-day Adventists. Today, there are over 414,000 Seventh-day Adventists in Rwanda. 5% are Muslim. The roots of Adventism in Rwanda can be traced back to the work of David Delhove. This young Belgian learned about the Sabbath from a tract sent to him by an uncle who lived in America. He became an Adventist and was sent by the British Union to Kenya in 1913. His mission service in Kenya was brought to an abrupt halt when he was drafted into the Belgian Army, the start of World War I. And part of his assignment was gathering intelligence, and he traveled in the area of Rwanda, which gave him the idea that maybe this would be a country that would be ripe for Christianity. So after the war, Delhove was able to persuade Henri Monnier to return with him to Africa. These stalwart pioneers were given three mission stations that had been used by the German Protestant Society. Gitwe was established as the first Seventh-day Adventist mission in 1921. It was situated on a site where no African would live because it had been cursed by a chief. The first baptisms in Rwanda were in 1924. A school was opened at Gitwe in 1925. Delhove retired in 1944, but he continued to work in the Congo until his death in 1949. The story is told that this dedicated man of God was trying to convert his orderly who was taking care of him 10 minutes before he died. In 1938, a young California couple, married for only 1 year, was asked to join the mission staff at Gitwe. Our father, Parshall Howe, taught in the school. Mother had the privilege of teaching the children of the other missionaries. Life was not all work. The couple was able to enjoy time camping at Lake Kivu. This jewel of a lake lies in western Rwanda on the border with the Congo. We enjoyed our stay on its shores during our recent trip. It is certainly a beautiful place to find rest from the press of mission duties. The school at Gitwe supported outlying schools. This school was a bit more humble than the secondary school at Gitwe. Mass baptisms were held then as they are now. Pastor Robert Jones and several local pastors are seen here probably around 1938 or 1939. Robert Jones is another dedicated man of God who gave his life to Africa. His duties included visiting outlying schools. One of these trips took him into the Congo. While there, he was asked for help by the local people if he would help them find and kill a wounded Cape buffalo. These animals are normally very aggressive. A wounded buffalo would be even more to be feared. The hunt was unsuccessful. On the return trip to camp, the group found a hive of bees. While harvesting the honey, they were surprised by the wounded buffalo. Pastor Jones helped the others escape the charge, but he did not make it up the tree. He died of his wounds and was buried on that lonely trail in the Congo. It took 5 days for the word of his death to reach Gitwe. It became my father's sad duty to tell his widow and 5 children what had happened. Charlotte Jones and her children returned to the United States and settled at Pacific Union College. I came to know her as the gentle neighbor lady that lived down the street. We were neighbors again in a very different place. As we look back to the growth of Adventism in this beautiful country, I wonder, what did our message say to these people? Did they come to a better understanding of how to be stewards of the land? How to feed themselves and their neighbors with what they could grow? Did it help them think for themselves so that they would not depend on the dictates of a chief, a king, or a preacher? Did it give them the understanding they needed to cross the deep-seated animosities of tribalism? Did it prepare them for the storm that was to sweep their homeland in 1994? We shall see. Back to Gitwe and the couple from California. Their first child was due. There was no suitable doctor available locally. The expectant mother traveled to the Adventist hospital in Ngoma, or now known as Muganero. She stayed in the home of Dr. and Mrs. Rittenhouse. The house overlooks Lake Kivu. It was peaceful and beautiful. A month after her arrival at Ngoma, I arrived. The medical complex was peaceful then, but it was to suffer terrible damage during the storms that swept over Rwanda in 1994. This little church that was there when I was born would look down on the worst carnage in a single day at a single location during the 100-day storm that swept over Rwanda in 1994. In the 1990s, more than 90% of the population in Rwanda were professed Christians. This made Rwanda one of the most Christian nations in the world. There were then about 280,000 Seventh-day Adventists, and the church was thriving. In fact, Rwanda was perhaps the most Adventist country in the world, since more than 10% of the population were baptized Seventh-day Adventists. The storm that had been gathering for decades finally hit Rwanda with the ferocity of 1,000 Katrinas. On April 6, 1994, the president of Rwanda and Burundi were killed in a plane crash over Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. The next day, the prime minister of Rwanda was assassinated. The wave of violence that swept across the land of 1,000 hills was terrifying. Tutsis and moderate Hutus were targeted in a systematic plan to extinguish them. Citizens were told to rid the country of the cockroaches that threatened them. The horror of the planned, systematic hunt for thousands of Rwandans has been the subject of many reports. Unfortunately, these reports did not receive notice in time to avoid the death of 800,000 people. It is said 10,000 Adventists died in the 100-day genocide. Frantic Tutsi and Hutu families sought sanctuary in places of worship. Muganero Hospital stood for healing and hope. Surely this place would provide the sanctuary promised by people that found rest on the seventh day. Elisifan Nitakarutamana encouraged the frightened Tutsis in the surrounding area to seek sanctuary at the hospital, and many came. It soon became clear that the storm was approaching even this haven of hope. Water was cut off and the roads were blocked. Friday, April 15, the compound was surrounded by heavily armed Hutu bands and members of the Presidential Guard. 7 Adventist Tutsi pastors on the hospital compound wrote a letter to their conference president. How are you? We wish to be strong in all these problems that we are now facing. We wish to inform you that we have heard that tomorrow we will be killed with our families. We therefore request you to intervene on our behalf and talk with the mayor. We believe that, with the help of God, who entrusted you the leadership of this flock, which is going to be destroyed, your intervention will be highly appreciated, the same as the Jews were saved by Esther. we give honor to you. He answered that letter, but the answer from their spiritual leader, Pastor Elisifan Natakarudamana, surely extinguished the last shred of hope for Sanctuary. His response, face your fate like men. One report quotes him, and I hope this is not true. God doesn't want you anymore. The plea, we wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families, has become the title of a book about the Rwandan genocide. On Sabbath, April 16, 1994, 2,000 were killed in the church, and hundreds more were killed on the grounds of the hospital. Church leaders say that probably as many as 99% of the Adventist workers in the Muganera region, including pastors, hospital workers, and employees, died on that fateful Sabbath. On February 19, 2003, the Adventist News Network reported the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and incidentally that is in Tanzania, sentenced a former Seventh-day Adventist administrator, Elisifan Natakarudamana, to 10 years in prison, and his son, Gerard, to 25 years in prison for their roles in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. The report goes on to say about its February 19 decision. The United Nations Tribunal said that Gerard Natakarudamana, 45, a medical doctor practicing at Muganera Adventist Hospital, was convicted of genocide and of crimes against humanity, murder. And Elisifan Natakarudamana, 78, was convicted of aiding and abetting in genocide. Trial of the Natakarudamanas lasted 12 months. Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, was one of the defense lawyers. The presiding judge was Erik Mosse, a Norwegian, who was vice president of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda at the time. How could these men do what they did? They were not the only Adventists involved in the senseless slaughter of people, simply because they were Tutsi or Hutu sympathizers. How could this happen? I might add that clergy from other church communities were also tried and convicted. As we contemplate the question, listen to people caught up in this horrible storm. Listen to what they have to say as they look back on those horrible days. The Natakarudamanas have continued to maintain their innocence. Pastor Elisifan Natakarudamana was released from jail and did die a month after his release. His son, Gerard, is still in jail. These men were jailed for their acts. Why they did what they did, we cannot say. But one prisoner, who admitted to killing six people, talked to Bob Simon of 60 Minutes. When asked why he killed, he said, "They told me that I would be rewarded with a piece of land and a banana plantation. They told the same to the other people, but you can see they didn't give me a banana plantation. They told you you would be rewarded with a banana plantation if you did what?" Simon asks. "They told us to kill, and we killed. We just did it," he said. This woman, like countless others, was raped. Many contracted HIV/AIDS. Their plight is indeed a very difficult one. Seen as outcasts by family and neighbors, they continue to carry a very heavy burden. Jocelyn Ingaberry is 39 and has HIV. She is the mother of two daughters. The oldest, Jasari, was born out of a loving relationship with a husband that was killed. The second child, Leah, is the product of a brutal rape. In her own words, "I never loved Leah. I love my first daughter because I gave birth to her as a result of love. Her father was my husband. My love is divided. I love the other girl now only because it is becoming apparent that even she is my daughter. Slowly, I'm beginning to appreciate that this one is innocent. Immaculée Ilibagizi is the author of the book Left to Tell. Immaculée grew up in a loving Christian family and studied electronic and mechanical engineering at the National University of Rwanda. Her website sums up what happened next to this Tutsi woman. Immaculée's life transformed dramatically in 1994 during the Rwandan genocide when she and seven other women huddled silent together in a cramped bathroom of a local pastor's house for 91 days. The bathroom measured only 3 feet by 4 feet, and remember, it held eight women. When Immaculée left that cramped little bathroom, she heard in painful detail of the deaths of her family. Only one brother, who was out of the country, survived. She married an American employee of the United Nations. They live in New York. She now speaks out about the power of forgiveness in her life, and I have heard her speak. She's powerful. Bob Simon interviewed her for a 60-minute segment in December of 2006. The report of this interview includes the following. When asked if she wanted revenge, she said, "Revenge only prolongs the pain." So Immaculée has forgiven Alex, the man who killed two of her relatives and would have killed her if he could have found her. Asked if she felt angry when she saw him, Immaculée said no. Her journey to this place of forgiveness is truly miraculous. Her book chronicles this remarkable journey. There are other people that have been deeply affected by the genocide. General Romeo Dallaire was the UN commander of the small peacekeeping force in Rwanda during those problem times in the early 1990s. Months before the genocide storm broke, he warned of the rising tensions. His continued efforts to inform the United Nations of the situation in Rwanda failed to mobilize the help he so desperately needed to quell the violence. The rest of the world did not want to hear what he had to say. He returned to his native Canada. He suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome and came to blame himself for the genocide. He was found one day under a park bench in Toronto, drunk with an overdose of drugs. From this low point in his life, he has gone on to become a member of the Canadian Parliament and is a sought-after speaker. Paul Rusasabagina is the child of farmer parents. He started his education with the intention of becoming a pastor. He went to the Seventh-day Adventist College of Gitwe and then attended the Faculty of Theology in the Cameroon. His life then took a turn into the world of hotel management. The events in April of 1994 found him as a temporary manager of the Millay Collins Hotel in Kigali. During the genocide, he was able to shelter 1,260 Tutsi and moderate Hutus in the hotel. His own wife was a Tutsi and faced certain death if the hotel was overrun. His story is told in the film Hotel Rwanda. For his actions in the face of grave danger, he was awarded the 2005 U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom. The citation reads as follows. Paul Rusasabagina demonstrated remarkable courage and compassion in the face of genocidal terror. During the Rwandan genocide in 1994, he risked his own life to shelter more than 1,000 fellow Rwandans targeted for murder. His noble and selfless acts have been honored around the world. His life reminds us of our moral duty to confront evil in all its forms. The United States honors Paul Rusesabagina for his spirit and bravery in defending and caring for his fellow man. Carl Wilkins was the director for the Rwanda Adventist Development and Relief Agency in April of 1994. He sent his family out of the country in a U.S. convoy when the U.S. ambassador advised all U.S. citizens to leave the country. Carl, with the prayerful consent of his wife, stayed behind to protect Rwandans that had sought safety in his home. By the night, and I'm quoting an article from the Adventist Review, by the night of April 10, Wilkins was the only American left in Rwanda. For the first 3 weeks, Carl was unable to leave his home. He then ventured out into Kigali and helped save many lives. Those of you who have been fortunate enough to hear him speak cannot forget how God provided and used him to save others. Here's what he says about the experience. I think we need to remember, recognize the potential that each of us has for evil and the potential that each of us has for good. That's the bottom line. The battle between good and evil, and whose side I'm going to take. I call Pastor Soraya Mbangakira my Rwandan angel. He stayed with Carl Wilkins during that awful time in April of 1994. Carl gave me his email, and we have exchanged many precious messages. He helped us plan our trip to Rwanda. We have continued to communicate via email since my return home. He has stated his dream of providing Steps to Christ to university students in his country. He visited our Banning Church website and saw the offer for free Steps to Christ. He asked if we could provide more than one for his project. Pastor Soraya gives two copies to a university student, with the promise that they will share the second copy with a friend. Pastor Vollmer felt that our church could not take on such a large project at this time. A friend, who is not a member of the Adventist Church, heard me telling Melinda Vollmer about the fact that we would have to deny the request, and I did not know how I was going to tell Pastor Soraya no. This friend wanted to know how much money we needed. I named an amount and told her we would match it. She promptly wrote a check for that amount. To date, we here in the Banning Church have raised $1,320 for the Steps to Christ project for Rwanda. But that's not the end of the story. I told this story to friends in Maryland, and the Triadelphi Church in Maryland has raised, and this is probably considerably more by now, over $2,600. The combined amount is enough to buy 12,400 copies of Steps to Christ. Elder Howard Scoggins of the Review and Herald Publishing Association tells me this is the perfect book for Rwanda. He said books there are read and reread until the covers fall off and then they are read again. I wonder how far-reaching will be the influence of our church website, which was the seed for this project. Abidan Ruhangika is the director of the Youth, Sabbath School, and Personal Ministries departments for the Rwanda Union Mission. He is the kind, thoughtful guide who drove us around Rwanda. On the way to Muganero, we stopped to see his family. Abidan's parents live in a small, attractive house at the end of one of Rwanda's many dirt roads. He said simply that two of their sons, his brothers, were dead. His sister is the widow of a pastor killed during the genocide. Not only did she lose her husband, but her two children as well. At our request, Abidan took us to the genocide memorial in Kigali. 250,000 bodies are buried here. I remember how he quietly followed me through the rooms. There was nothing any of us could say. As we drove along the winding roads of Rwanda, I asked Abidan what the church was doing to help the young people of Rwanda process the genocide. He said, "It is impossible to forget." Then there was a long silence, and I was almost sorry I had asked the question. Finally, he said, "I preach the love of God." Before our visit to the Muganero Hospital Complex, we spent the night on the shores of Lake Kivu. The sunset was magnificent. What a beautiful, peaceful place. Friday, we drove to Muganero. The road was considered too rough for Abidan's car, so we rode in this pickup, and we carried other passengers in the back. This busy hospital now serves 175,000 people that live in the surrounding hills. It is staffed by two Rwandan-trained doctors, and I might say that the genocide decimated the doctors in the country. Either they left the country, they were killed, or as the one case story I told you, they did the killing. There are 35 nurses, one lab technician, and one x-ray technician who has an incredible story to tell of his survival during the genocide. We were told they see about 90 people a day in the outpatient clinic. We walked through one room where mothers with small babies were waiting for medicine to treat their HIV/AIDS infections. The hospital has been helped to recover from many sources. We saw a truck from the Columbia Medical School. ADRA Japan has contributed to the laboratory, and they were quite proud of their laboratory. Adventist hospitals in the Rocky Mountain Adventist healthcare system have sent supplies and personnel on a rotating basis to help with selected projects. A group from Denver arrived shortly after we left. One obstetrical nurse wrote in her blog dated July 13 of this year, "The recovery room is a regular room shared with two mothers and their babies, as well as the families." Get this, the families provide the food, linens, and comfort for their loved ones, which explains why I saw no linens on the bed. The families have to bring them. It's basic at best. Occasionally, they have running water. No bathrooms in this building, no electrical outlets. The families were grateful for the baby blankets and the hats that were provided by the many busy hands from the Denver area. The Muganero Medical Complex is again a beacon of hope to the people. Eager students were anxious to hear what visitors from America had to say about teaching in school in the United States. As we walked around the complex, we were reminded of that day in April. As Abidan told us, it is impossible to forget. A cement slab covers the burial site of thousands. I was told 25,000 people were buried here. In the middle of the hospital complex is this memorial. Abidan said it was for the pastors who died. Yes, Muganero is a beacon of hope for the future, but the message is we must not forget what happened here in the past. Sabbath, we visited Gitwe. I sat in the little church where I was taken as a baby. Incidentally, I don't quite know what was happening up front, but there was a lady leading out. It was my first Adventist church. We met this dear lady who remembered Bwana Hawa, as they called my father. She also knew where Bwana Jones was buried on that lonely Congo trail. We met the son and daughter of Simeon, the faithful man who cooked for our family. He knew just how to coax the wood fire to get it going, to bake the bread and make the soup. Mother said he was a good cook. There are about 900 students at Gitwe this year. We worshiped with them, and oh, how they could sing. The small son of the local mission treasurer told the children's story. He was probably 7 years old, maybe 10. I could not understand what he said, but he had great poise in the front of the full church. Abaddon explained it is the policy to involve children in the church in every possible way. After church, we were followed by happy, playful children as we walked around the campus. We saw students waiting for their noon meal. Let me tell you about their noon meal. Lunch was on the tables in the cafeteria. A large bowl of rice and what looked like peanut gravy was next to the stack of dishes. What would our boarding school students think if this was their Sabbath lunch? What would you think if this was your Sabbath lunch? I stopped and looked down the drive and thought about our parents those many years ago. What was it like at Gateway those many years ago? Were the students as full of life and hope as they now seem to be? Were they taught what it means to love God and your neighbor as yourself? No doubt they were. Did they understand just what love really means? As we drove through the gate, I noticed another enclosed cement slab. By now, I had an idea what it might be. Abaddon said it was a memorial to the pastors who died. As he said, we cannot forget. Back in Kigali, we visited the beautiful new campus of the Adventist University of Central Africa. The old campus, which saw so much death during the genocide, has been purchased by the Rwandan government. We were told the enrollment is about 2,000 for this year. Many of the students attend in the evening. Many are not Adventists. Saturday night, Pastor Soraya arranged a dinner for us. We met Pastor Soraya's son-in-law. Dr. Hirsan Byrangiro is the president of the Rwandan Union Mission. He, like many Rwandans, had left the country. He is now an American citizen and had lived here in this country for 15 years. He had not planned to return to his native land, but his church needed him, and he responded to the need. He explained that he could not stay for dinner because his nephew was having an engagement party. The boy's father had been killed. Pastor Byrangiro was standing in for the dead father. The genocide has affected all of life in this country of 1,000 hills. Leaders of the church and the world have spoken out about the genocide. President Clinton in 1998 on a visit to Rwanda. The international community must bear its share of responsibility for this tragedy. President Bush, after visiting the memorial in Kigali in February of this year, there is evil in the world, and evil must be confronted. Dr. John Paulson, president of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, said during a visit in Rwanda in 2005, "Why is this most Christianized of African countries, where almost 90% profess to be followers of Christ, did such a thing take place?" One can try to comprehend the magnitude of this tragedy, but it's impossible. It is with humility that all Christians must examine the events of 1994. And it is with sadness that the Seventh-day Adventist Church must also acknowledge that in the midst of this tragedy, many church members, people who should have known better, failed to display basic love and care for their brothers and sisters. Ray Dabrowski, who is the communications director of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, spoke out after the International Criminal Tribunal of Rwanda had sentenced Ibisifan Ntakarama and his son. "Christians should reject violence as a means of conflict resolution. The heart of the Christian message is reconciliation, compassion, and love, which transcends any difference of language, race, or nationality. We acknowledge with sadness that some of our church members turned against their fellow members and their neighbors. We are saddened that the accused did not act in harmony with the principles of their church. we offer an apology. What were you doing Sabbath, April 16, 1994? What would you have done if you knew what you know now about that fateful day? We certainly owe it to our Rwandan brothers and sisters to never forget. Apologies have been offered. What lessons must we learn? Are you tempted to pass judgment on the events in Rwanda? Before judging, I would say we must look deep into our own hearts. Has greed clouded our behavior? What do you think you must have? That car? Those shoes? A new sofa? A new TV? Before judging others, we must look deep into our own hearts. Then we will know we have no right to judge. Has our relationship to authority clouded our behavior? Who tells us what to do? What candidate to vote for? What clothes to wear? What to believe about Bible prophecy? Before judging others, we must look deep into our own hearts. Then we will know we have no right to judge. Has exclusivity clouded our relationships? Who are the they that do not belong? Non-believers? Immigrants? Women? People who don't look like us? Before judging others, we must look deep into our own hearts. Then we will know we have no right to judge. This mother is the wife of the mission treasurer, and she has just been to church at Gateway. Her little one is wearing his Sabbath shoes. What would you say to her if you could share Sabbath dinner with her right now? Remember, someday we all hope to be eating together with our Heavenly Father. J.J. Norty, who was president of the Africa Indian Ocean Division of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which oversaw Rwanda, in 1994 said the following when reflecting on the lessons of Rwanda. I believe the Lord's return is delayed, mainly because we cannot live together yet. If we can't live together here, God is too loving to bring us together in His kingdom.